Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. And my very special guest today is Guy McPherson. Guy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very glad to have you here. You come very highly recommended. I'd like to know why. Would you be able to explain just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
It's inexplicable that I'm highly recommended. Apparently, you're talking to the wrong class of people. I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. I left active service at the university 4.5 years ago, in May of 2009, at the age of 49. And I've been studying climate science for about 30 years. And now most of what I do is organize and synthesize research put out by other climate scientists and update the public through various means on the direction and history of climate change.
So would you be what they call and demonize as a climate denier, even though you don't deny that there's a climate?
Oh, no, I'm by no means a climate change denier. Most people have me in the far other end of the spectrum. I think we're headed for near-term human extinction as a result of climate change, and I don't think there's anything we can do at this point to avoid that fate. So most people say I'm worse than deniers because I don't point out that we should be, you know, driving Priuses to try to extend our run. I think it's too late.
Yeah, well, I've always found the Prius one quite a great irony, because electric cars send off a whole lot of electrical signals and magnetic fields and so on and so forth that cause cancer. So that'll teach you to save the environment.
Well, it's worse than that, anyway. Too. the energy that goes into a Prius is far greater than the energy required to make a Hummer, for example. And so you have to drive a Prius for a really long time before you have a net return on the energy investment. Those batteries are just hugely expensive in terms of the energy input.
It's just freaking marketing, isn't it? Now, is that one of your assessments? It is mine that climate change, and indeed allegedly trying to fight it, is merely just now a marketing ploy so that certain people can make money, even though humanity is going to die anyway.
I think there's a spectrum, a continuum, and that there certainly are people who are promoting the idea that we need to take certain actions so that we can mitigate the climate change damage, and most of those recommendations are ending up making people a lot of money. So there's a lot of greenwashing going on. I also think there's a lot of people who are pretty ignorant and who are captivated and captured by culture, and so they're just doing the things that sound like they make a little sense. So recycling, for example, what's not to like about recycling? So I see various
Your webcam appears to have gone off there. If you could quickly reset it, that'd be nice. But yeah, I agree on the recycling thing. You know what the bad thing is about recycling? It doesn't actually get recycled, and it gets shipped all the way to fucking China to basically be buried in a lot of cases, or at least the New Zealand garbage does anyway.
Well, right, and it's, again, there's a broad spectrum of outcomes there as well. Some recyclables actually get recycled, and a lot don't, and it's just highly variable. It depends on where you're at and how committed various people are to doing various things. But bear in mind, too, that, for example, recycling paper almost always takes way more energy than cutting second and third and fourth growth timber to turn it into paper. So it's sort of a zero-sum game. In addition,
which in itself... Which in itself actually costs a lot more energy than, say, a similar quantity of hemp.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And not to mention that recycling is the third R. Remember, we've known about the three R's for a long time: reduce, reuse. Nobody talks about those because there's no money in that. So the corporate state is not going to tell people that they should reduce consumption because that would cut into their profits. So they're all about the third R, the one that doesn't make any sense but makes some people a little bit of money.
Well, is there some kind of an industry going here? Because whenever there's a great scam throughout history, there seems to be usually a massive clique involved, creaming it, you know, off the top, off of everybody else's ignorance, more or less.
Well, I think at the level of civilization, and especially industrial civilization, the whole thing is unsustainable, and the outcome is to produce a lot of money for a few people and depauperate the rest. So Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich, in their book One with Nineveh, written maybe 12 years ago now, described the American system of industrial economy, of capitalism, as capitalism for the poor, socialism for the rich. The rich always get bailed out. The poor never get bailed up. So we have grinding capitalism for the poor. You know, Leonard Cohen sang about this a long time ago. Everybody knows the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls their fingers crossed. Right? So everybody knows the fight is fixed. Poor stay poor and the rich get rich. So it's been going along like that for a long time. Is it all by design? Well, I don't know. If so, that design goes back a few hundred years, or arguably a few thousand years, if one include all civilizations, since the first civilizations arose. Certainly there are people who have taken advantage of the system and have landed themselves in the sweet spots. And so here I'm thinking about certain politicians and certain bankers and banksters and, you know, the people who are deriving a huge amount of monetary gain from the work of the 99.9%.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that in any way indicative that psychopaths are actually in control of society at the moment because they crave power and control and find their way into those positions where they have lots of it?
Absolutely. There's the whole system. If you wanted to design a system that would maximally benefit the sociopaths, you couldn't have done any better than the system we have now.
Which would lead me to believe that they designed the system.
Well, it could be. You know, it could be that they had this in mind, that at least certain people had this in mind. But, you know, it's been this way since the first civilization arose a few thousand years ago.
Sumeria.
Right. And actually, in a relatively short period of time, as the climate warmed, coming out of the Pleistocene and into the Holocene, civilizations arose in several places simultaneously on various continents. So, yes, we know... Probably the first one was Sumeria, or among the first ones was Sumeria, but there was a lot going on in a period less than 1,000 years long. Yes, we had civilizations arise a long time ago, and throughout history, those civilizations have benefited a few at the expense of a whole bunch of worker bees. So there's really nothing new about the current industrial civilization, except that it's accelerated, and it looks like at this point this is the worst of all civilizations, the least sustainable of all civilizations, and it's the one most likely to collapse in a relatively short period of time, while benefiting those who are pulling the levers of industry all the way down.
Is therefore your conclusion that they're purposely trying to crash the world civilization so that most people will die and they'll be able to then seize control of the entirety of the planet, and including all remaining survivors, into their fold in a kind of a dark age forever?
No, that's not what I think at all. I think that they lost control. A guy named Van Jones, who was Barack Obama's green job czar for the 15 minutes he thought that was a good idea. Before Van Jones became part of the Obama administration, he gave a speech September 1st, I believe it was, 2007, in which he said that, and I'm going to paraphrase here. He said, "I've been to Davos, and I've sat with Bill Clinton, and I've sat down with Bill Gates, and I understand how these people think, and I understand that they know they lost control. You think they haven't put peak oil into Google and figured out what that means in terms of collapse of civilization?" He says, they're just at this point, they're just juggling chickens and chainsaws, trying to keep the game going for another day. If they can get through the end of the day, they're considered a major success. So I think they lost control, according to Van Jones, and what he said was believable. After all, this is before he became part of the Obama administration. So he didn't have any big incentive to lie yet. He said that they lost control when oil peaked in 2005, when crude oil peaked. So they're trying to keep the balls in the air. I don't think anybody, not even a sociopath, would want to commit us to human extinction in the near term. But that's where we're headed. And it's not just going to kill 99% of the people on the planet. It's going to kill all of us. And they surely know that, but they figured that out too late, because you don't know about self-reinforcing feedback loops or so-called positive feedbacks until they've already been triggered. Well, we've triggered a couple dozen now, and there's no going back.
Yeah, I think Dane Wigington from geoengineeringwatch.org sent me an email about this, that there's some kind of gargantuan methane release happening in the polar regions of the Earth right now, and that has a permanent effect that is only going to grow and get worse to the point where we are facing entire eco-collapse.
Right. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. It's not Vegas. And so when that's the planet's air conditioner. And when we destroy the planet's air conditioner, that's horrific, because then we are headed right to runaway greenhouse. In a very short period of time, the planet is going to heat up beyond the ability to do anything about it. Without that ice, you know, we haven't had an ice-free Arctic ever when human beings were on the planet. Not ever. And we're headed there. If not next September, then the September after that, or maybe the September after that. But in a relatively short period of time, we're going to see an ice-free Arctic. Meanwhile, most mainstream scientists, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are calling for an ice-free Arctic in 2050 or so. There's no way. No way we make it to 2020 with ice in the Arctic in September.
So these recent reports that have been coming out where they have record ice growth and everything in the North Arctic, that's what do you make of that?
Well, that whole series of articles started with a report in the Daily Mail, which is a somewhat less than reputable paper in the UK. And they pointed out correctly that the ice cover in the Arctic had increased substantially from September 2012 to September 2013. Well, there's a reason for that. In September 2012, we saw the lowest ice cover ever recorded in the Arctic. And so when it increased by 30%, I believe it was, from one year to the next, the comparison was to the lowest ice cover ever reported to a significant but relatively small increase in cover within the next year. That ice cover in 2013, although it was considerably higher than it was in 2012, was still about 2 standard deviations lower than the long-term average. They failed to point that part out, that it was still nearly 2 standard deviations lower than the long-term average. So ice cover is still way reduced relative to the long-term average. The trend is down, down, and all down. And yes, there will be these occasional blips.
We're going to have to stop that there. We're coming to break. Be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Guy McPherson. Don't you go anywhere. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting live from the fabulously Fukushima irradiated, fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, where everybody has such high rad exposure that they've managed to snap up a part-time job as an eco light bulb, which is good for the environment, especially with the mercury in them. Well, my very special guest is Guy McPherson, who reckons we're all fracked anyway. So what's your assessment of the situation? Do we practice yoga, learn how to kiss our own ass goodbye? Do we just say frack it? You know, everything's going to be screwed up anyway. Let's go and execute a few bankers. It'll be fun. What's your assessment of the situation? We're all going to die anyway. So what do you do about it?
I propose we do the same kinds of things I've been proposing we do for years, which is to pursue a life of excellence. Pursue what you love. Do what you love. You know, we've known since we were 10 or 12 years old that birth is lethal, right? I think most people recognize that they weren't going to live forever before they hit their teenage years. And even if you live a really long time, what does that mean? It means you live to be 90 or 100 years old. That's the blink of an eye. That's almost nothing. I bet you talk to most people who are 90 or 100 years old and on their deathbed, they'll think that it comes down to a few memories, that their lifespan really wasn't all that long. And so You know, regardless of whether we live to be 20 or 30 or 40 or 90, it's a relatively short period of time. Let's try to pursue a life of excellence. Let's try to do the things we love. Let's try to not make the world a worse place for humans and other organisms while we're here. I think Socrates had it right. For him, pursuing a life of excellence meant he was just going to keep asking questions. Keep people answering him his relatively simple questions until they finally killed him for it. But he was pursuing a life of excellence by asking the same six questions over and over and over again. And, you know, I think that's not a bad way to go. I should be so lucky.
Well, I do think that pursuing a life of excellence is in itself its own reward. A life of mediocrity, is in itself its own punishment.
Yes, absolutely. And it seems that that's what this culture would encourage us to do, pushing us to do, is pursue idiocracy and not pursue a life of wisdom, not pursue betterment of ourselves and our situation, but instead pursue a few dollars so that, for the most part, other people can make a whole bunch of money.
It seems a pursuit of pleasure and fun, entertainment, being vain and vacuous and ignorant appears to be the main preoccupation with people these days. Would you agree?
Absolutely. As nearly as I can tell, that's been the approach for 100 years or so. The pursuit of pleasure for pleasure's sake is promoted, encouraged, and completely bought into by the vast majority, at least here in the United States. I can't speak for other places. I've traveled a little bit to other places, but I've lived my entire life here and spent very little time outside of this unbelievably bizarre culture. But certainly here, the television carries the day. You know, it's an Aldous Huxley world we're living in which people are accepting restrictions on their freedom and being convinced that this is a wonderful life. Even though, if you take a look around, the freedom has been missing for a long time. It's been degraded away for such a long time that it's hard to recognize, well, as freedom to me.
Mm-hmm. I think a nice Ashton Kutcher movie could be in the works. You know, dude, where's my freedom?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we have Big Ag controlling our food supply, Big Energy poisoning our water, Big advertising agencies controlling the messages we receive by the thousands every day, corporate media telling us the important news for the day, corporate governments telling us how we should act. Through it all, we think we're free. Freely?
It's a big, giant illusion. And one of my arguments that I raised with somebody the other day surrounding climate change is that the climate change argument and activism has hijacked all forms of environmentalism. Almost no other form of environmentalism exists anymore. There's bugger all media coverage, funding, and support. So if you want to get rid of, say, pesticides, which are known to cause cancer and deformities in babies, there's no funding for you. There's no media coverage for you. And we have the highest cancer rate in human history. Nobody's doing anything about it. And then you look at, well, let's say Fukushima radiation, virtual media blackout there. What's more dangerous for you, carbon dioxide or 10,000 years of radiation? What else have we got here? We've got parabens, which are in all of our products, bisphenol A, alanine, which mimics estrogen, so it gives men a feminizing effect and gives women breast cancer. Then, of course, we've got, say, Agent Orange derivatives, lots of different forms of contaminations, heavy metal contaminations, mercury contamination from these light bulbs seeping into the groundwater. We've got fracking doing it as well. We're in the middle of a massive economic sort of driven environmental nightmare. Yet the only thing that is getting any attention amidst this nightmare is a element that is technically naturally occurring in a lot of cases, that plants need to breathe. I think that if we're going to focus on getting rid of a certain contaminant, we shouldn't be focusing on one of the four building blocks of life, water, sunlight, carbon dioxide and oxygen. Instead, we should be focusing on all these very unnatural, man-made chemical contaminations that really are killing people right at this very second.
Well, let's go even deeper. You're absolutely right, and of course, you only listed a few hundred things that we're doing incorrectly at this point, things that are poised to kill us. But let's go a little deeper and get to the root of the matter. I'm a radical. And most people don't know what that means. It means to get to the root of. And that's why that little mathematical symbol, the square root sign or the cubic root sign, it's called a radical, because it gets to the root. Everything you describe, and let's tack on GMO foods, and dirtying the air with pollution, and fouling the water with pollution, and driving to extinction 200 species a day, and on and on and on the list goes, and going deeper into human population overshoot at the rate of more than 200,000 people a day added to the planet. What's the root of all that and everything you mentioned? It's industrial civilization. Industrial civilization is driving the whole thing, and that's a system that allows for a relatively few people to derive great financial benefit on the backs of a whole bunch of really poor people who are made poorer every single day. So, yes, I would agree that Fukushima represents the greatest threat to humanity right now in the short term. In fact, I would argue that industrial civilization and two of its primary byproducts, nuclear power and global climate change, represent the double bind, the trap that we've already stepped into that will kill us all in the relatively short period. If for example, we keep industrial civilization going, we're headed to 4 degrees C warming in a relatively short period of time. Well, guess what? We've never had human beings on the planet with 3.5 C above a baseline. If we terminate industrial civilization in a short enough period of time to stop runaway greenhouse, then we trigger the catastrophic meltdown of more than 400 nuclear power plants around the world. Think Fukushima to the 100th power. That's going to be inconvenient.
Well, that's an inconvenient truth right there. And speaking of which, have there not been articles or climate change advocates who have said that nuclear power is going to save the world from climate change by annihilating us all with deadly radiation?
Absolutely, and one of the most famous climate scientists in the world, James Hansen, who recently retired from NASA, is promoting nuclear power. I think it's absolutely absurd promoting a quote, energy source that, like the other fossil fuels, depends on a finite material. You know, we know that there's finite amounts of uranium and plutonium, and that we have never figured out what to do with the waste. We've never figured out how to deal with it. And that plutonium sits around for, you know, a few hundred thousand years and is extremely toxic to humans and other animals that whole time. Who thought that was a good idea? It's a terrible idea. It's always been a terrible idea. And to think, to feed our addiction to electricity with nuclear power while claiming that runaway climate change is a prospective problem is absurd. For one thing, building the cooling towers for nuclear power plants generates so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that nuclear power plants don't become carbon neutral for 20 years or so, at which point it's time to start shutting them down because of safety concerns. So nuclear is not a carbon-friendly approach. It's a terrible idea.
Do you believe that Agenda 21 will save us from all of this by exterminating the population, more or less, forcing everybody off the land into smart growth cells where they'll be chipped and heavily monitored, and if anybody says anything against the government of the day, they could just get their chip turned off and they can't identify themselves or buy food?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on Agenda 21. I think that the so-called powers that be, the banksters who have been running this country and other civilized countries for a long time, lost control. I think they lost control when oil peaked, and that they're scrambling now. But things are breaking down. You look at what is happening in the Middle East. You look at the Occupy movement. You look at Idle No More. Things are breaking down, and the ability of the police state to surveil and control its populace is declining. So things are breaking down on every front. They're breaking down at the level of the ecosystem, at the level of civilization. The response to the decay of civilization, to the power of the corporate state, the response is to ratchet up the power. And so now we see, you know, police departments all over this country receiving free or at nominal charge all kinds of high-tech military equipment from the Pentagon. So the Pentagon is essentially giving away these devices that better serve to herd the masses, to keep them all lined up in a row and behaving properly. Well, they lost control. Plain and simple. Consider, for example, if we wanted to impose martial law in the United States. Well, as I understand it, there's about enough military to control the people in Manhattan. You know, maybe they can control somewhere between 10 and 30 million people. What are they going to do with the other 300 million of us? I don't think that's a viable option at the level of the country.
It depends. Well, I don't know, because a lot of people will say this, but there are shockingly large amounts of classified technologies that we don't even know about to a large degree. So you never know. Maybe they only want to control about 30 million of the population. That's like, what, 1% of the population? And maybe they'll just... there's a weapon called Scalar. Have you heard of Scalar?
I have not, no.
It's a... It's a frequency kind of sound weapon, I believe. But basically, what it does is it can send a harmonic tremor, kind of like an EM pulse. But instead of disabling electrical systems, you can disable things specifically, particularly bioelectric rhythms. So you could target a city, put its pulse on, and then you could either have the pulse set to disable all bioelectric rhythms, so every human would die, or you could even target it even more specifically, like all of those with black skin would die, because everybody's got a particular frequency that your heart beats at and your brain waves function at, and they can apparently attune this technology to target specified individuals or entire populations, even specific races, particular colors of eyes and things like that. On top of that, we have what are known as soft kill weapons, you know, vaccine virus releases. Apparently that was tried in Austria. What was her name? Jane Burgermeister exposed this a number of years ago, because there was a shipment of vaccines in from, I think, Baxter's International that was contaminated with a bird flu virus. And as a result of this contamination, it became very clear that there was an agenda at play, because in order to have a virus... a vaccine material of that quantity contaminated in such a way, there's something like 30 to 50 different security checks and protocols that have to fail simultaneously in order for that to even become a possibility. So if you add in bioweapons, censored technology, they don't really need boots on the streets in order to control people. Add on to that psychotronic weaponry, which can actually control people's thoughts and actions, and other classified technologies that some whistleblowers are coming out and talking about. It's, you know, the answer is, I don't know. We'll be right back after the break with Guy McPherson.
I stand alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder, incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly Zeke parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls, these hangman rope sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick, trap, rob, wreck, butcher, and murder the people that keep them terrorized in gangster Frankenstein earphone radio slavery for the communist gangster government and con artist parroting puppet gangster playboy scum on
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about a gangster Frankenstein earphone radio slavery, broadcasting directly into the soft tissues of your brain and projecting images of terror and fear and scumbaggery. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of madness and chaos and our subsequent extermination, if you lose a sense of humor, you'll go frickin' nuts. And my very special guest is Guy McPherson. And we were talking over the break about how it was a number of years ago that the Gulf of Mexico oil spill happened. And that kind of got me bolt up outright of bed. And I was like, you know what? I think the Bible prophecy about a third in the life of the oceans is going to die is starting to come true. And when that's starting to come true and it's happening right in front of your eyes and you're still working for some scumbag corporation and you're still trying to make money to make ends meet, you kind of think to yourself, this doesn't fucking matter anymore. I'm going to quit my job. I've got to start exposing scumbaggery and doing what I want to do with my life full time, because I'll never get another chance at this. And this is part of the embodying philosophy of my life, is that, well, I'm gonna get exterminated or probably, I don't know, I'll be found in a sack on the side of the road, head cut off, arms and legs shorn off as well, and the sack will be neatly tied with a bow, found in a ditch, and it will be ruled a suicide. All right, that's as basically as I assess the situation of anybody who actually tells the truth in a society full of lies, deception, and scumbaggery. That's my assumption. And that's why I'm doing this, because I actually like the idea of being killed with a neat little bow wrapped around me. You know, it'll be nice. It'll be fabulous. It'll almost be like a perfect justification for my very existence, that somebody actually has to kill me and in order to subvert everything that I stand for in order to beat me. Maybe
well,
that's
there's
a
no question
dark.
That Socrates became quite well known, and in part because he was killed, because he kept asking those hard questions. You know, you brought up a lot of issues right before we went to the break, and it brings to mind there are a lot of things that are going on, and we often don't know what many of those things are, what underlies them. And we don't have a lot of control over a whole bunch of those. So what I try to focus on is the phenomena that I do have some control over. So what I do is encourage people to secure clean water and grow healthy food and maintain their body temperature and develop a decent and loving human community, because those are the attributes human beings have depended upon to thrive, not merely survive, throughout the first 2 million years of the human experience. And if we leave the corporate government or the corporate media or the corporations generally in charge of any of those, we're letting our own freedom slip away. So let's not get bogged down in a bunch of phenomena over which we have absolutely no control, and instead work on the things that can make our own lives better, as well as improving the lives of the people and other organisms around us.
I think you're right, because anxiety is what happens when you're worried about what's coming around the corner that you can't do anything about. Anxiety and fear prevent the brain from working properly and prevents you from clear thinking processes, whereas solving problems that are right in front of you, that you can actually solve, gives you personal empowerment, gives you confidence, not only, it shows actual benefit. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen out there, if you're stressing out or you're anxious about something, ask yourself this question. Can I do anything about it? Is my anxiety actually improving the situation? And is there something else I could be doing where I'll actually accomplish something instead? What do you think, Guy?
Yes, absolutely. Take control over your own situation, you know. I am an anarchist, and I promote agrarian anarchy. Anarchy is not chaos. Anarchy is the absence of rulers. Chaos is the absence of rules. And I promote and practice agrarian anarchy in the same sense that Henry David Thoreau did. And for me, what that means is taking responsibility for myself and for the well-being of myself and for my neighbors, human and otherwise. That's what anarchy is. Anarchy is not capitulating to the government, not capitulating to corporations, not allowing other people to exert control over my existence and therefore impinge upon my freedom and the freedom of my human neighbors and my non-human neighbors. So I'm a huge fan of having no rulers. We still have rules, and those rules are characterized by decency, by freedom, by the
non-initiation of force.
Right, exactly. So let's not force our will onto humans or other organisms. At the current rate, we're forcing our will to the exclusion of a couple hundred species every day. It doesn't seem like a very good approach to me, because at some point one of those species becomes us.
I thought it was like 20,000 a year or something even worse, 200 a day, but I could be wrong. I'm not familiar with the stats on that scenario. And it occurred to me that it's not just, changes in the environment and temperature and so on and so forth that's causing that mass extermination. It's purposeful contamination of the environment with unnatural chemicals and hazardous waste and things of that nature, which must be contributing massively. I believe, what was it? Was it DDT or one of the other Monsanto evil pesticides or something of that nature? Trade winds blow it north, and now allegedly the Arctic is one of the most DDT contaminated regions on the planet. And it blows it up there, and then it doesn't come back down.
Right. I mean, we're doing so many things, and almost all of them we're doing wrong. Right, so this is one of the primary reasons I promote resistance against this omnicidal, overwhelming culture. The dominant culture is responsible for so many ills and so little going well that I promote resistance against that culture at almost every level. How could we not do that? Why would we not do that? It seems sheer lunacy to me that we capitulate to corporations, to corporate governments, to corporate media, that we let them exert control over our lives.
Is it because we've been taught by them and trained by them? I think the Jesuits actually had it down correctly. Don't you think that they've had us all since we were yay big in their public schooling system? And now we are merely the adults that they made us.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a reason the public school system works the way it does. It was designed that way.
There was, I think it was Jordan Maxwell, who said that the government doesn't want your children to be educated, okay? If there was something wrong with the education system, they would change it, but they're not changing it, are they? They're only making it worse. Have a look at the test scores for Americans today, and they're what, like 50th? They're like the 50th out of 200 plus countries, okay, in terms of education. So unbelievably dumb that it's not even funny. And I talk to a lot of Americans, and they're intelligent ones, heads in their hand, hoping that the next person that they run into that they have a conversation with isn't one of these mindless slave scum, right? It's almost like trying to avoid a plague of stupidity while walking around your own frickin' homeland. Have you ever had that sensation?
Yes, and you know, when I point out to people that the education system is working the way it was designed, they give me a funny look. Oh, surely you can't mean that. You must be some sort of conspiracy theorist. Well, let's go back to an 1888 report of the United States Senate, the Committee on Education. And we can summarize that report in a single sentence. Quote, "We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes," end quote. In other words, education is making people too smart, smart enough that they were questioning the system in which they were embedded. So away went the private education system, and immediately was implemented the public education system, which has this remarkably restraining set of standards, which become more and more constraining over time. And so now we have teachers spending hours of their day every day preparing reports, daily reports, to be sent to the parents indicating whether their children are behaving well or not. So they spend a significant proportion of their time in this country reporting on how well-behaved the students are instead of educating the students. Not that I would necessarily want them to be educated in the way that the system is designed to educate them.
It's funny you should mention that, because you know how the older generations always say, well, back in my day, we were never that bad, and so on and so forth. Well, it turns out that the rates of drink driving among teenagers, violence, crimes, so on and so forth, are actually really declining quite sharply in New Zealand. So, in a way, you're correct. We are filtering out these behavioural problems whilst at the same time filtering out any education or ability to fight a system that doesn't have your best interests at heart. And I think that's public school in a nutshell. We'll be right back after the break. Sit down, shut up, learn what I'm telling you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Guy McPherson. And I was wondering, Guy, can you explain to me, you know, how did you get into, first of all, the recognition that the Earth is fracked, and secondly, the recognition that having an anarchist, i.e. a non-authoritarian view on the world, where did this first get instilled? Did this start with when you were a boy in university? Did you get your head cracked by the cops at a protest or something? What?
I suspect the anarchist tendencies came as a result, at least in part, from reading a lot of Edward Abbey when I was an undergraduate in college. Edward Abbey is the desert anarchist who's lived most of his life in and around Tucson, Arizona. And he conducted his master's degree at the University of New Mexico and did a thesis on anarchism. And so he actually understands what anarchy is, and wrote about it compellingly his entire adult life. And so that was pretty influential for me. Where did I get to where I am in terms of the planet being fracked? Well, I was a conservation biologist from the early days of conservation biology, so I know about species extinction rates and what causes extinction. Mostly it's loss of habitat that causes extinction. And I was editing a book on climate change in 2002, 11 years ago now, and I concluded, based on pretty scanty evidence at that time, that we had probably triggered events likely to cause our extinction in the relatively near term, like 2030 or so. And I mourned about the loss of our species to the bemused curiosity of the two or three people who noticed. And then about a year later, I discovered the concept of global peak oil and realized that collapse of industrial civilization might just allow our run as a species for another generation or so. But that was a long time ago, and the system keeps going, because the system keeps chewing up the living planet and kicking more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're nearly 400 parts per million in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's never happened in the history of humanity. We're at 1,800 parts per billion on average methane in the atmosphere. That's never happened in the history of humanity. That's about 2.5 times what it was at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So everything at this point indicates to me that we're headed for a relatively near-term demise. That's based on a strongly scientific perspective. I just don't see a way out of the trap at this point, and it still causes me to mourn.
Yeah.
But I'm also hilarious, at least when I speak in public. So I think that you can have a sense of humor in light of impending doom. And if you can't, well, it's going to be a pretty miserable way down.
Yeah. What was it? I think it was Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 3 that said it the best. Your levity is good. It relieves tension and the fear of death.
That's good. Like, yeah, I long ago wrote that, citing Shirley MacLaine here, a person who can laugh at themselves will never cease to be amused. Well, if you can laugh at the apocalypse and you can laugh at yourself, you'll never cease to be amused. Yeah. If you can't laugh at yourself and you can't laugh at the apocalypse, you got some serious dark days ahead, given where we're headed.
Yeah. Well, it's medicine, I think. At the moment, people are sick with worry, and there's really only one treatment that a doctor can prescribe, I think. Go and see the great clown Poliachi, and he will pick you up. The man burst into tears, and he says, "But doctor, I am Poliachi." Yeah, it's a good joke, and I think we've lost that, particularly in this movement here. You know, people who talk about reality, the real harsh reality. We've got so many soft, weak, terrified people out there who are afraid to deal with reality, and I think that this is their greatest weakness. It is not a strength to ignore reality. As Ayn Rand said, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. This is the situation that we find ourselves in now, I believe, is we've got a group of ruthless criminal psychopaths at the very top, whether or not they're just normal human beings or some kind of off-world entities, as some people have speculated. I don't care. I don't look at what the causation is. I have a look at the effect, okay? And if you have a look at the effect, it'll basically start to attune to you what the causation is. And you mentioned peak oil, and I've had I have had a couple of experiences along this line. One was I saw a textbook in a community hall when I was looking after autistic boys one time, and I read through it and it had a section on peak oil, which, and I think this textbook was from 1979 might have been mid-80s, I forget. But it said that because of peak oil, all oil will be gone by like 1997 or something like that. And I said, well, That didn't come to pass, and this is in a textbook. So how can peak oil be true? Have a look at the oil prices and how they keep fluctuating. They keep coming up and then coming down. If peak oil was true, they'd never come down. They'd only keep coming up because oil would keep running out. They never find new resources and so on and so forth. So that's not true either. Then we have Lindsay Williams, who was on the Gull Island, Alaska oil drilling operation, where they found literally an ocean of oil underneath the crust that, that dwarfed, I think it was something like 8 times that of the Saudi Arabia oil reserves. And instead of tapping it and running the pipeline through to the United States, it was sealed off and no oil was allowed to be extracted from it. And it turns out that the elite of the world who he was associating with control the production of oil, control the oil companies, and are specifically perpetuating the scarcity myth so that they can maintain control over humanity's energy consumption. If you want to control humanity, control their energy consumption. And in the IMF, I think it is, offices in London, so Lindsay Williams has told me, that's where they set the prices for oil for OPEC every day. And as a result, they've managed to have complete control over the entirety of humanity's energy consumption to a large degree. This gives them control over humanity. He who controls the food controls the world. He who controls the water controls the world. He who controls the energy controls the world. And on top of that, you have a massive body of evidence and work of alternative energy devices which have either managed to increase the efficiency of the consumption of fossil fuels ad nauseum. I think there was some guy who was who drove away a car from a showroom one time, and he drove about 200 miles, and he noticed that the fuel gauge hadn't gone down at all. So he took it back, and they said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you accidentally drove away with one of our experimental models. Give us back. Here we go. Here's your proper car." And he's like, "Well, hold on a second. How come there's a car that can drive 200 miles to the gallon, and it gets suppressed?" It's because I think if people had to consume 99% less petrol or gasoline, as it's called in the States, they would have virtually unlimited transport potential and virtually zero pollution coming out of those cars as well. Most of the pollution that comes out is unburned hydrocarbons, whereas if you vaporize petroleum products, they tend to fire over a greater surface area and consume much of the fuel, about 99% or so, and have 1% emissions as opposed to 99% of the emissions kind of thing, and only 1% of the fuel actually being burnt up, or something of that nature. So there's a complicated situation here whereby peak oil is becoming, to my mind anyway, I might be sure that you disagree, is a bit of a fraud perpetrated by the oil companies like Rockefeller, Standard Oil, what are they called, the Royal Family Controlled BP, the Dutch Royal Family Controlled Shell, that are now working as a cartel, what they call the Seven Sisters, and they control the world's energy supply through that racket, essentially.
Well, I couldn't disagree more. Peak oil is real. We passed the peak in crude oil extraction at the global level in 2005 or 2006. The game is being kept going now by fracking, by shale oil, by tar sands, by very expensive kinds of oil. In fact, fluctuating prices of oil in the wake of oil's peak is exactly what was predicted by people who were doing the science 2 decades ago. Why? Because the price goes up and up and up as demand grows, as it outstrips supply, and then demand collapses. So consider what happened in 2008. July 2008, the price of oil went up to $147.27, and then boom, we're in the Great Depression, version 2.0. Demand completely collapses. There's no demand for oil anymore. Nobody can afford it at those prices. Everybody's out of a job. Nobody's driving to work anymore. Nobody's building anything. The housing bubble completely bursts, so now oil is priced at $34.20 at the spot level. This kind of fluctuations are exactly what was predicted by people studying the issue a decade and 2 decades in advance. So
the fact that Lindsay Williams came out 9 months before that drop from $147 a barrel to $46 a barrel, and he told everybody that the elite told him that that drop would happen for a period of 9 months, are you saying that that didn't happen? It was just a natural market thing, even though he knew about it 6 months in advance?
I'm not saying that the markets are true free markets. There is considerable manipulation of all markets, and the Federal Reserve Bank, through their monetary policy, is influencing, as nearly as I can tell, every single so-called free market at this point, as is the U.S. Treasury Department. But none of that matters anyway, because we can argue all day about peak oil, and you're going to quote some anecdote with no evidence behind it about how a car drove a long way. There's no evidence for any of that. You're going to quote Lindsay Williams, who most people would consider to be a fringe player at best. And none of that matters anyway, because we've triggered near-term extinction as a result of burning so many fossil fuels. Peak oil did not save us. It will not save us. We're done. I thought it was going to save us, and sure enough, oil peaked, crude oil peaked in 2005 or 2006, depending on which set of data you look at. But it's hopeless now. At this point, we're done. Hope, as Nietzsche pointed out, is in reality the worst of evils, for it extends the torments of man. It's game over.
Mm-hmm. And what about the term fossil fuels? Where did that come from?
That's a fine question. Whenever a professor says that's a good question, it means he or she doesn't know the answer. So I don't know where that term fossil fuels came from.
I heard that it was from the La Brea tar pits in Los Angeles. Upon their discovery, they found animal bones and plant matter that was stuck in the tar pits. And so they said, wow, that means that this oil derivative must be made out of animal bones and plant material that has been, over time, turned into this oily substance. And they ran with it. It's the same principle as saying, I've got a vodka martini here that's got two olives in it. Therefore, this glass and the vodka and martini is all made out of olive derivatives. Right? Doesn't make any sense. And during the oil price shock in the 80s, a lot of allegedly wells in Texas, and I think this was part of the reason why the oil price shock happened, they ran out of oil because they were doing sort of almost virtual surface drilling, you know, only not that many feet down to do their drilling. And they ran out of oil in those wells, so they capped them off. And then about 10, 15 years later, they go back just to check on them, and those wells are full of oil again. So something's replenishing it. Now, I don't think that a whole bunch of dinosaurs just, managed to just migrate their way into that empty oil thing and then just decompose themselves over 15 years. So I think that the whole term about fossil fuels is also not widely understood either, nor is the availability of oil.
Fossil fuels are called fossil fuels because for all practical purposes, they are finite. And they are finite. We can go around and around on this, but again, we're avoiding what seems to me to be the central issue by hoisting up red herrings and talking about them ad nauseum. They're irrelevant. We're headed for near-term human extinction. Every petroleum geologist I've ever known has concluded that gas, oil, and coal are fossil fuels. There's no juicy nougat in the core of the earth that is regenerating oil, call it abiotic oil or whatever other nonsense you want to come up with. That's not happening. Let's talk about the important issue. Let's talk about how we act, what we do, in light of the extinction of our species and the sixth and worst great extinction in the history of the planet.
Okay. Never mind then. What would you like to say then? Because you clearly don't want to discuss this issue.
Well, it seems. First of all, we're not going to agree. My view about fossil fuels is supported by petroleum geologists around the world who have been studying the issue for a long time. You're going to quote Lindsay Williams and cars that drive for 200 miles before somebody notices that the gas tank hasn't gone down. A notion that I hear all the time but have never seen a single bit of evidence to support. Mm-hmm. I hear about cars running on water, that violates the second law of thermodynamics, but nobody seems to be concerned about the second law of thermodynamics anymore. You know, they're called laws. They're not called the strong suggestions of thermodynamics.
Is murder against the law? Just because something is a law doesn't mean it can't be broken. That's what I've found is physics and science seem to have this, just like public education, there's an indoctrination level here where you will educate people to a certain point and then teach them that everything else can be denied and say that there's no evidence whatsoever because I've been told and believe what I've been told. We'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, Guy McPherson is my very special guest. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seems. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, my very special guest is Guy McPherson. Is it Pherson or Pherson?
Whatever you choose to
It doesn't call. Matter, does it?
And
have you got a website, Guy?
I do. It's at GuyMcPherson.com. That's Nature Bats Last. If you put Nature Bats Last or my name, Guy McPherson, into your search engine, it'll take you right to it.
You seem kind of low there. Can hardly hear you.
How's that? Is that a little better?
That's a little better. All right. Okay. Now, moving on from peak oil, because it's clear we're not going to agree on that one. I agree that climate change is happening. I believe that humans do, in fact, have a role to play in it. But I don't believe that taxing every form of human activity is in any way going to solve said problem, especially if the money is given to the bankers. What about you?
Well, I think, the civilized climate scientists, the ones at universities and large government agencies, have been proposing carbon taxes for a long time. I think it's ridiculous. I can't imagine a situation in which that would cause any reduction in burning of fossil fuels, and if that's the goal. In addition, there's something called Jevons Paradox, which we've known about since William Stanley Jevons wrote a book in 1865 called The Coal Question, which says the more efficient we become at burning fossil fuels, the more quickly we use them up, and conservation doesn't matter because what you conserve is used by somebody else. The carbon tax, all these proposals to fix the situation are completely misguided because it's too late to fix the situation. We're done. And I don't know how many times I need to say that before one or two people actually take notice and start living as if the day we're here, to quote Nietzsche. Carbon taxes have always been a ridiculous idea. In addition, the time to implement strategies such as that was decades ago. We know that there's a 40-year lag between emissions and consequences. So the impacts we're seeing on the environment now result from fossil fuels that were burned 40 years ago. It's not like we're going to be able to turn this around the day after tomorrow because we impose a carbon tax. That's wishful thinking.
Okay. Then what is the agenda of carbon tax? If it's not to save the environment, what's the agenda?
I strongly suspect, I can't...
Just speculate, I mean, and
I can't speak for the people who propose imposing such lunacy, but I strongly suspect it's the same as it is for almost every other artifact of civilization I see. It's to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. I don't see that anything about the way civilization operates and has always operated does anything differently than that. I think that's what the whole thing is about. You know, consider when the first civilization arose. Here's one definition of civilization for you. Suddenly the food isn't free. That's the definition of civilization. Up until civilization arose, you could go around and pick up food off the ground and out of the trees and eat whatever you wanted. The water was the same way. Now, all of a sudden, everything costs. Everything that used to be free costs, right? So eating, drinking, those used to be free activities. Now we not only impose a price on seemingly every human action, but we also impose taxes on seemingly every human action. And the benefits all go one direction.
See, this is why I think carbon dioxide was indeed the key to the globalist plan of world domination, even if they've lost control. And as you say, they're all dead anyway. They're insane, so I don't think they get that. but it's that every single human activity, from respiration, industrialization, anything of any kind, produces carbon dioxide. And so if you want to control all human activity with absolute impunity, what would you tax?
Yes, well, I can see where you're going, but just because living produces carbon dioxide doesn't mean we as human beings are destined to tax carbon dioxide. After all, the first 2 million years of the human experience, we didn't live like this. We didn't know there was such a thing as civilization. And in a few instances, people who discovered civilization and then had those civilizations collapse returned to a more sane set of living arrangements that didn't involve civilization. So that indicates to me that civilization is not a one-way street. It's a cul-de-sac, but it's not a one-way street. Only industrial civilization in the post-nuclear age is a one-way street. We can't go back. We can't suddenly terminate civilization now, let the thing collapse and come out of it alive because of all that ionizing radiation we're going to trigger into the atmosphere.
And there are people who, like, cling to this hope, oh, there's going to be some great invention, some technology that is previously unreleased or undiscovered that's going to come and clean up all the radiation, clean up all the air, clean up all the contamination in the environment, and we'll all be sweet. Don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah.
That just seems like wishful, messiah complex insanity to me.
Absolutely. That's just more capitulating to authority in one form or another. Frequently when I speak, I have people come up to me and say, well, I think the aliens are going to save us. I say, okay, all right, so pretend for a minute that I'm the alien. Now you convince me why you're worth saving. And then there's just a blank stare. You know, this is asking, begging somebody to save us besides ourselves so we don't have to do anything. Well, I think we're well beyond the point that us doing anything really matters, but one of the reasons for that is that we've become so shackled by industrial civilization that we let the people who appear to be running the show keep on running the show. And so that way I don't have to make any decisions. We'll just let them make all the decisions. Whoever they are, it's them. I don't need to do anything. I just need to let somebody else do something and I'll sort of get out of the way here because they're really in charge.
It sounds like a trained dog.
Well, there's a difference between training and education. Education encourages people to learn and maybe even think. Training is for dogs and other organisms. Education is for humans. And it seems that we've been trained and entrained into a system that is absolutely insane. We're the hamsters on the treadmill, and people are looking around just thankful they have a job. Just, isn't it wonderful that I have a job? And not even recognizing what their job means. It means that they're letting somebody else run their entire lives. And yeah, thinking that's a good thing because they get a few bucks out of the deal.
Mm.
Wow.
I recall, Guy, I was at a protest, and we were trying to draw public attention towards the government selling all of our state assets, energy assets, health care, the sovereignty of the country, essentially all of our freedoms getting sold down the line, trying to raise awareness of this for a protest the very next day, right? This guy comes up to me. And I've been doing this for about 6 years. All of my financing comes from my listeners, because I bring on even people like you, but who I don't necessarily agree with on certain issues. But you know, I try to give everybody a platform and try and be a little bit fair and not be a dick about it. But this guy says to me, "Why don't you go get a job?" And it's like, why? Why would I want to go get a slave job? So I could be a slave like you. So every day I can get in my slave car, get stuck in slave traffic, go to my slave job, get ordered around by my slave boss, get given my slave money at the end of the week so I can go home to my slave wife and my slave children and drink my slave beer and watch my slave television just so that I can forget about how much of a freaking slave I am before I go to my slave job tomorrow. Why would I want to do that, bro? He just walked off.
We're so bound to the monetary system. We think we absolutely depend upon money for our lives. And as a consequence, we end up chasing that job because that's where the money is. It wasn't that long ago that human beings spent a few hours each week securing their food and water and maintaining the body temperature and having a decent human community surrounding them. Now we spend 40, 60, 80 hours a week to generate enough money so that we can drive our cars and buy our food and buy our water, pay the taxes, so that, sure enough, we can have food, water, body temperature, and a decent human community.
And then we're too tired to care about our other people around us in our community, too tired to plant a garden, and too tired to haul water.
Yes. It's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy.
Yeah. It's a planned society. And this is what people don't get, that their lives are controlled virtually from day one to a large extent. And it's only when you educate yourself, I've found, that people actually click on to this. Nobody comes up to you and says the world's a controlled experiment by the elite and you're just one of their slaves and so on and so forth, and that person just suddenly get it. No. Nobody woke me up, ladies and gentlemen. I had to watch 160 documentaries on varying different topics in a period of a couple of months before I actually started to wake up. I woke up myself. So did everybody else. Nobody who does zero study and just believes what they're told is awake. It's not freaking possible. And I get sick of people actually, you know, disagreeing with me. Oh, but Vinny, you woke me up. No. You chose to listen to me. You chose to listen to the guests. You chose to do a whole bunch of other research supplementary to listening to this radio program. I didn't wake up. Shiite Muslim. You woke up yourself.
That's
stop.
Right.
And this is a thing, Guy. Everybody puts these thinkers and what they perceive to be authorities, they're simply playing the same game. Oh, this authority figure is trying to wake me up and trying to help me, unlike the other authority figures that are trying to destroy me and enslave me. And the reality is, it's actually your appeal to authority that destroys and enslaves you.
Yes. It's for many, many years when I was at the university, I taught that all learning is autodidactic. All learning is done by you. I can present information, but it's up to you to learn. Most teachers are so filled with hubris that they think their teaching is what is allowing the learning. And that's true to a very, very limited extent. But to a far greater extent, individuals learn because they're given information and then have an opportunity to compare that with other information and go a little bit deeper themselves. Ultimately, all learning is autodidactic. That's a tough thing for a teacher, and I was teaching for a very long time. That's a tough thing for a teacher to admit, because teachers, including myself, certainly lack humility, and so we think we have considerable control over what people are going to do, how they're going to think, how they're going to learn. Well, that's generally not the case. That's up to the individuals to figure it out for themselves.
What structure do you think, let's say the Earth wasn't going to end, hypothetically, for a moment, and we wanted to come up with a new education system, a new public education system that actually undid all the wrongs of the current public education system. Would that be possible, or is that simply like, I don't know, trying to balance out the equation of you missing one leg by cutting the other one off?
I think the latter is correct. I think that the system is irredeemably corrupt. It cannot be fixed. I see a lot of people who pass themselves off as environmentalists trying to negotiate with the system, trying to make little changes to the system here and there. But the system itself is irredeemably corrupt. It cannot be fixed. We must terminate the system and start from scratch. And for me, that scratch means anarchy. It's the model promoted and, to a certain extent, proposed and promoted by Thomas Jefferson a really long time ago. Monticello was a center for agrarian anarchy, in which food was the primary basis for trade, for commerce. Now, there's the whole slavery thing. Okay, so I'm not suggesting that was a good idea by any stretch of the imagination. But we don't have to go very far into the future from that, and we're at a system proposed and promoted by Henry David Thoreau, for example, agrarian anarchy. That's okay. The way that
we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with Guy McPherson. GuyMcPherson.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
Show broadcasting live from the Chateau de Rothschild in the Isle of Sicily, where we grow wonderful cocaine that we use to bribe European politicians in order to put in our carbon taxes, I see.
And my very special guest is Guy McPherson. Now, for this last segment, it's a short segment, Guy, so quickly, I just want you to reiterate what are your websites so people can go and find you on, as well as Facebook, other contacting details as well. And then finally, I'd like you to round off the interview. If there's any information that you've come across that actually kind of scares you, that you kind of, or maybe things that people don't really agree with, they tend to insult you, or maybe think that you're crazy for even thinking it. This is a place where you can express those kind of ideas and not be judged. So if there's anything you wouldn't normally say on talk radio for fear of that, you can, and I invite you to do so.
Great. Thanks, Vinny. My website is GuyMcPherson.com. It's called Nature Bats Last. You can find it at GuyMcPherson.com. No A's in McPherson. I also write a monthly essay for Transition Voice, and that's TransitionVoice.com. And I also write periodically for the Good Men Project at GoodMenProject.com. I have a book out last month called Going Dark. It's my 11th book. You can find all of my books at my website. And that book reaches the conclusion, the truly horrifying conclusion, that we are headed for human extinction in the pretty near term. And I give a little bit of advice based on that information about how we might want to live as human beings in the world, hopefully as decent human beings. And then I guess the thing that I would say that most people aren't aware of is the malpractice being conducted by the likes of Bill McKibben and James Hansen, who promotes a carbon tax. Bill McKibben, who's a founder and really the identity behind 350.org. These people know that we can't get down to 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for at least the next 1,000 years. All the science points in that direction. And yet they keep promoting 350 parts per million with their website, 350.org. By the way, 350 parts per million is a death sentence for many, many species on the planet and also for many human beings on the planet. We aren't going to get there. They keep promoting it as if we can. To me, that's malpractice. I write about this and other matters on my website, GuyMcPherson.com, and most comprehensively in my latest book, which is called Going Dark, and it's been out for about a month.
Now, these people being derelict in their duties, do you think they're intentionally misleading people because they're getting paid off by banksters in order to promote their agenda, or are they just not checking their facts correctly?
I think that's a combination. They're not checking their facts. And in the case of 350.org, the entire identity of Bill McKibben at this point is wrapped up in 350.org. So his whole identity is going on the road, flying around the world, telling people to stop driving the cars and stop flying in planes to try to reduce the carbon emissions. But that's his whole identity now. 350.org, if he's forced to admit that we are never going to see 350 parts per million in the atmosphere in the entire human experience, what is he going to do? That's his whole identity. That's as rigid, as difficult an identity shock as it was for me when I walked away from the university life that I loved because I recognized that the whole system is fundamentally corrupt. And my most recent book before Going Dark is called Walking Away from Empire, and I describe the situation which had me walking away from a very desirable set of living arrangements at the height of patriarchy, at the height of the white man's world. Here I was making a decent living for doing relatively little work at a university. I couldn't stand that anymore, so I walked away. That's a huge identity shock, and I think that's what people would be faced if they had to turn their message around. It's a difficult challenge to turn your message on a dime.
It's essential, though, isn't it? And I think it's part of being honest. Not only honest just in general, but being honest with yourself. Because it's all very well if you can excuse yourself and say, well, somebody else lied to me and they perpetrated fraud and I believe them, therefore they scammed me, so therefore my personality is fake. Right, because of somebody else's BS. But it's when you lie to yourself, when you're not honest with yourself, that's a hell of a lot worse, in my opinion, because then you've got nobody to blame.
Yes, and that almost immediately goes to lying to other people. How could you not? Once you lie to yourself, it's easy to take that message to other people. And when it comes to matters of identity, I understand perfectly well how hard it is to be honest with yourself about what you're doing and where you're headed and what your message is and the validity of the message. And so changing that means changing your entire identity, changing your whole life. That's tough. Because now you're getting to your head and you're getting to your heart. You're not talking about going from one construction job to another. This is tough stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think without suffering, without pain, you don't actually learn any lessons of great importance. Everything else that's real easy to learn, easy to process, has very little value to a large degree. It's when you go through those massive shocks, those huge changes, that's when you find out who you really are in your head and in your heart, because you're forced to actually deal with what's really in your head and your heart. And the rest of the time, most people are just walking around in just flat-out denial because they can't deal with the reality that they are not who they think they are, that their thoughts are not their own.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I interact with a lot of people who are preparing for the end of industrial civilization or the end of the settled living arrangements or blah, blah, blah. And they're worried about the zombie hordes that are going to come. The zombie hordes are already here. Look around. We have an entire zombie civilized world. These people walking around, going from their job to their house, collapsing into bed at night, getting up in the morning, doing the same nonsense as they were doing yesterday, feeding the beast, not feeding themselves, not feeding their own heart, mind, and soul, but just keeping this system going. Why? Well, it's a little hard to tell. But I think it's because we were all born into captivity and we've been enculturated by, quote, normalcy bias in this extremely abnormal period in history.
Yeah, it's an ironic existence, don't you think? And I like grasping the concept of irony because it's a source of much amusement. I see it everywhere I look.
Yes, if you just look around and see what we do now compared to what we as a species or as human animals did for the first 2 million years of our experience, you just got to wonder, how did we ever get this point? What kind of salesman sold us on the idea that instead of working a few hours a week, we should work many hours every day and, in fact, do a job that is so horrifying, so horrible that it makes my wrist hurt so bad I can't even sleep at night because it's all redundant. So we go from this way of living that has each individual capable of doing an enormous number of things, and they're all pretty interesting and exciting, and you're not even working very hard. Mostly you're having fun and making art and interacting with the human beings in your community and getting along with nature and doing all those wonderful things. And then suddenly we go to the set of living arrangements where we're working our butts off and it's killing us, literally killing us and killing the living planet. And we think it's a great deal because we're making $8 an hour? Come on.
Well, it's insane. And you asked what kind of salesman sold us on this idea? I have an answer for you. A snake oil salesman.
Yes, I suspect you're right about that.
Incidentally, the Primarch, interesting, you're talking about the Primarchal kind of society here, the peak of the white man, of the Rockefeller oil family, was in fact a snake oil salesman named Big Bill Rockefeller, who was one of the first people to develop a franchise where he would hire lots of con men to scam large quantities of towns in the Old West and kept all the money for himself and then became an oil man.
Some people can see
oil
what was coming.
To just regular oil. You're going to love that.
Some people can see what was coming from a long way away and made decisions that enriched themselves and their children. But we're nearing the end of the line now. It's time to start living as if our lives actually matter, living in a way that gives us joy and makes the world a better place instead of making the world a worse place every day.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. Guy McPherson, ladies and gentlemen, at guymcpherson.com is the website. And I'll just say this. The reason why I'm not earning $4,000 or $5,000 a month as I used to be, and now I'm living on like $300 a week or whatever, is because I realized there is nothing that exists that I value or currently have that isn't going to be taken from me anyway, whether by hook or by crook. It doesn't matter. It's all illusionary. It'll all be gone soon enough. And what I do on this radio show is I'm trying to essentially live a life that when I die, I can be proud that I lived, that I didn't deliberately deceive people, that I didn't make the world a worse place in my final years upon this beautiful, beautiful planet that is now contaminated with massive amounts of radiation and oil plumes. Guy McPherson, thank you very much again.
And pleasure.
Thank you, ladies and
Thanks
gentlemen.
For having me on.
You're very welcome. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. And we desperately, desperately need your donations. My bank account are dry, just like the bottom of alleged oil wells. And we desperately need you to give $5 a month to this broadcast so that we can continue to supply you with some information, some controversial thoughts, and some decent frickin' people.
like Guy McPherson, ladies and gentlemen, the people who actually deserve the media promotion, not those who control the media, exterminate humanity. See you again.